Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Brain fog, shortness of breath, fevers, fatigue, depression. The constellation of lingering COVID-19 symptoms has taken months to come into focus. Why do some people suffer these symptoms shortly after the virus infects them? Why do other patients develop new symptoms months later? Are certain people more vulnerable to these chronic complications? Priya Dugal, PhD, is a genetic and infectious disease epidemiologist and an associate professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore. Priya Dugal, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hopkins recently launched a survey about long COVID with the goal of collecting responses from 25,000 people who have or have had COVID-19. What information are you looking to collect?
We're actually just trying to understand who has had long COVID. And in order to do that, we would love to know who's had COVID and then for them to report what their initial symptoms were and what they might be experiencing now, maybe a month or two post their infection, or as much as a year post their infection.
So, like, what kind of symptoms are people telling you about?
Yeah, so people are reporting lots of different things. They're saying things like they have brain fog, where their brain just sort of feels muddled, things like shortness of breath, or an inability to do exercise, or they're incapable of walking up a flight of stairs because they get so winded and they're very tired. There's some people that have had more severe symptoms like tachycardia, where their heart starts racing intermittently. And there are some individuals that are just really are suffering from depression that's new or anxiety that has increased or is brand new to them. Those are just sort of an array of some of the symptoms that people are reporting.
And so is part of what you're hoping to do with this investigation, this survey, is connect what kinds of symptoms seem to go together or what kinds of symptoms seem to go with some other physical attribute of that patient?
Yeah, I think we're trying to do a couple things. First is that we've been talking a lot about long COVID. It's starting to emerge in the literature or in conversation anecdotally because the people who have had long COVID are starting to talk about it, and they're starting to talk about it in really large numbers. And so when we as epidemiologists looked at this, we said to ourselves, well, what percentage does it really represent? And there have been some studies of hospitalized patients and also some studies of people that have just emerged, including some of our own work of non-hospitalized patients, suggesting that this might be as high as 30% of the population of people who've been exposed that are recovering in some way months post their infection. And so the first thing we want to do is just quantify it. We want to figure out what that number is, and we want a big enough number that it's representative of the general population. Given that there are 28 million infections, we're hoping we can hit 25,000 responses.
I want to linger on that percentage for a minute because it's a huge percentage, 30%, you think, and that's what you're testing, I understand, but it's looking like that order of magnitude of people have symptoms of some sort that hang around. Respondents to your survey are not required to have received a positive test in order to participate. Why not?
Well, part of the reason we didn't want to place that requirement is because we know that in March and in April, it was hard to get a test. You really had to be able to get a doctor's orders. And often doctors would tell you, you know, there's very limited testing. Do we need to test you? If we know you have the symptoms, you can just quarantine at home and be okay. And so we don't want to exclude those individuals that weren't able to get a test. We also know that there are people in a household where maybe the mom or the dad or the sibling, a college age kid, all get it. And the last person in the household doesn't test because everyone else has had it and has a confirmed case. And we also don't want to exclude those individuals as well. We want to welcome anyone who believes they have those symptoms to report. And we have ways to look at the data afterwards to sort of disentangle those people who had positive tests from those people who think they had it.
You're also asking people if they have been vaccinated. Why?
Well, something that we want to understand is what role vaccine plays in long COVID. You know, our first question when we designed it was just sort of to ask a question of, were you part of one of the clinical trials? And now as people are actually getting vaccinated in our communities, we just want to know, do you still have symptoms after you've been vaccinated? There are some anecdotal reports of people saying that they're much better after they've had a vaccine, that their long hauler symptoms have disappeared. And we don't know if that's just anecdotal or if that's real. But if we have an opportunity to answer that question, we're going to try to do so.
Well, could it be then that something about getting the vaccine improves symptoms? And if so, why would that be?
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't really know if it's true, first of all. If it is, it may just speak to something about the immune system. I mean, and this is complete speculation, but it's possible that perhaps that boost that you get of an immune response is enough to clear some lingering infection that these individuals still have, some lingering virus that's still there. So until we sort of are able to evaluate how many people are actually reporting those symptoms or how things changed after they got a vaccine, it's sort of hard to, you know, speculate. But I think the first step is quantifying it, determining it, evaluating it, and then we can ask some really deep questions about what might be going on with these individuals or think about people who haven't had the vaccine and perhaps test them in the future before they get the vaccine to see if something changes.
Within the 20 or 30% of people who have long COVID, the severity can really vary. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So some people are going to say they have a persistent myalgia. You know, one of the most common symptoms we see reported outside of our current survey is people just saying that they have an enormous amount of exhaustion, that they're incapable sort of getting up and moving. And that's outside of people reporting depression, and they're comparing that to their baseline, what they were before. And so that sort of sense of just being so tired that they can't work is one end of the spectrum. And then there are going to be people who, you know, have a new clotting disorder, or they have an acute kidney injury, or they have a new heart condition, which is the other end of the spectrum of where we're seeing cases. But they fall all along them. And some people have multiples of these symptoms, and some people have just one of them. Or maybe one or two. And so that's one of the things we also want to look at. Do certain symptoms cluster together? Because maybe that'll tell us a little bit more about the biology.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with epidemiologist Priya Dugal of the Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We're talking about emerging research into long COVID. So some of what you know came from following up with COVID patients who were treated at Hopkins. Tell us about one or two of the patients who spoke with you.
Yeah, well, without revealing too many details, I can tell you that there's at least some young individuals, you know, somewhere in their 20s, who they had a really mild case of COVID. They had some sniffles, some congestion, a mild cough. And months later, you know, 6 months later, they're not able to walk their dog without getting really tired and winded. And those are the types of stories that sort of raise some eyebrows with us, because how do you go from being someone who's young and vibrant to someone who can't walk your dog without getting tired? And that's sort of what made us think a little bit more about what long COVID might be and how it might affect individuals.
Your research includes studying genes to figure out why people react so differently to the virus. Explain that.
Yeah, so I'm actually a genetic and infectious disease epidemiologist. And one of the questions I ask in my normal research is, what role do our genes in humans play in our response to infections? And I look at a lot of different infections. And so COVID's no different here. One of the things we want to ask is there an underlying genetic response that you have, perhaps even that's controlling your immune response, that makes you more likely to have long COVID or makes you more likely to not recover for whatever reason? And so that's one of the things we're interested in looking at. The people who have different outcomes, is that controlled by some aspect of your genetics? And I'd say that we don't believe it's 100% genetics, right? You have to have COVID. So you have to have some interaction with the virus. But is there something else that's explaining why some people get really sick and some people don't? And some people get sick for a long time and others recover really quickly.
If it turns out there is genetic evidence that some people are vulnerable to long COVID, what would that mean for treatment?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. You know, how could we use that genetic information? And our goal is really to understand mechanism, to try to get at what's the biology underlying this. So if we could understand it, perhaps it pointed to a set of genes that explained why people had a lot of shortness of breath, or they were unable to walk up a flight of stairs, and it was all related to the same biologic mechanism. Maybe we already have a drug in existence that we could treat those individuals with. Or maybe we could target a drug for those individuals. Because if we're looking at something that lasts more than 6 months or 9 months, or in some of these studies up to a year potentially, we need to find some treatments for these individuals. And so our goal here really is to try to get at that biology.
So 28 million people in the U.S. have been infected with COVID-19. And I think then it follows from what you've told us that an estimated 5 to 8 million people are dealing with long-lasting symptoms or chronic conditions as a result. What does this mean for the overall recovery from the pandemic?
That's the thing that worries us the most, really. You know, we've been very focused on mortality, as we should be, because we've lost, you know, 500,000 people in this country. But what do we do about the people that are suffering from the long-term symptoms of this? And we say, you know, it could be, say, 20 to 30% of individuals who have these long-term symptoms, many of whom will report that they are still functional, but they're recovering. So they can still go to work. They can still deal with their day-to-day. But anywhere from 1% to 5% of individuals are saying they're not really functional. You know, they're recovering, but they can't do it very well. Perhaps they've had to leave their job or take a leave of absence, or they can't care for their kids. And there's just a question of how will this impact both our economy, but also their health and our healthcare system?
It's a big question. I appreciate your giving us this background. Thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you.
Associate Professor Priya Dugal is a genetic and infectious disease epidemiologist at the Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, we have a link to Hopkins' long COVID survey. Short break here on The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. When we're back, one woman's struggle with long COVID and her fight to be heard by doctors. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us on WYPR.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Last March, Shamir Smith, a Baltimore middle school teacher, got sick. Since then, she's navigated a maze of morphing and emerging symptoms, hospital visits, and dismissive doctors. She's also banded with other long-haul COVID-19 sufferers to advocate for research that includes diverse participants. Shamir Smith, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much, Sheila, for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You have been dealing with symptoms for almost a year. How have they changed over time?
Oh my goodness. What started out, you know, for me initially thinking that it may have been some type of cold or maybe at the most a sinus infection, quickly grew to blindness, vision loss, and body inflammation, joint pain that I even suffer from today, a slight psychosis, and brain inflammation, and sadly, now a spinal misalignment. So while some people get sick and their bodies start to progressively get better over time, my body started to progressively get worse over the last year.
Are things still getting worse?
No, they're not getting worse. I'm happy to say that I am finding a baseline with my symptoms where I can kind of predict, you know, when they'll arrive and what'll be my problems on any particular day, but they're not any less concerning. You know, having a brain inflammation, and just recently I was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment. Having, you know, neurological symptoms like these, there's still hills for me to climb, and I'm still very concerned.
What has been most helpful as you have tried to heal your body?
The things that have been most helpful for me, of course, are the COVID support groups, you know, knowing that there are other people who are struggling like me, who are trying to find answers, not only for themselves, but for each other. But also for me, I've also started the process of creating a personal and consistent routine of pacing and resting and being very careful about my activity level and paying attention to my symptoms, but, you know, still being able to create a space here in my basement where I've been for mostly a year, where I can meditate and take care of my body, you know, a little bit more cleaner eating and really listening to my body, which I never did before I got sick. And also having a very supportive family and some really close friendships have really, really helped dig me out of a hole over the last year.
A year ago, doctors didn't know that long haul COVID existed. What has been your experience at the doctor's office?
Oh, man. I have faced all types of forms of just being dismissed. I believe that I've experienced some racial discrimination while, you know, trying to get answers about my symptoms. I've been called aggressive. I've been turned away. I've been talked to as if I were a child and even offered a stay in a psych ward at one of our local hospitals. I have had some very some really hard and difficult experiences with doctors. And even, you know, more recently, I'm still finding that I am having to advocate for myself and challenge some of these doctors to let them know that long COVID exists. It is a real syndrome. It is becoming a chronic illness for many of us. And that sometimes is frustrating. I recall recently going to a doctor and leaving the doctor like with my head in my hands thinking like, it's been a year. We should be further along with information, at least knowing what long COVID is by now.
Is part of the problem, the dismissal that you've gotten from so many doctors, because you did not test positive for COVID-19?
Some of it has been that, but I think some of it has just been that there is some underlying expectation that as a Black woman, that I don't know my body, that I don't know my experience. So yeah, I will say that some of it has been because I didn't test positive, but some of it has just been outright disrespect. I mean, I've watched some things happen in the hospitals to me that should never happen to anybody, you know, and it has been humiliating to me.
So what advice would you give medical professionals right now on how to help long COVID patients?
I think that doctors and any other medical professional can listen to their patients. Many of us with long COVID have a slew of symptoms that we can rattle off in our minds like clockwork. Even myself, I can tell you 10 to 15, up to maybe 20 or 30 symptoms I suffer with still after a year. So I think medical professionals first have to listen more to their patients. Long haulers have become the experts of their bodies. Why? Because we had to be. When doctors and nurses were dismissing us and telling us that we didn't know what we were talking about, we had to convene together to find ways and therapies that would help each other. So medical professionals need to trust their patients. And I think a little bit more research on the authenticity of long COVID needs to be had by them. I still talk to doctors who don't have any idea what long COVID or being a long hauler is. And I think that's absolutely appalling after a year.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Shamir Smith, who spent nearly a year navigating the painful and complicated journey of life with long haul COVID. So what advice would you have for patients in your shoes, especially particularly Black women, to make sure they're heard?
I would definitely advise patients and especially Black women, because we have a history of not being taken seriously with a lot of our health issues, especially chronic ones. I would advise patients to start collecting medical notes, collecting documentation, and actually reviewing what doctors are saying, not being afraid to fire doctors, to dismiss them from your care if they're not giving the proper care, to file grievances with insurance companies so that doctors can be put, as we say in my in my class, on blast for not treating us the way that we deserve to be treated, and also continuing to talk to other people who are suffering with long COVID and even other chronic illnesses to get some tips and help on how to manage this, because it's not easy. It's not going away anytime soon, but patients still deserve to be listened to be advocated for, and to still be supported.
As you mentioned, one of the places where you found support has been in online communities for COVID sufferers. Tell us more about that.
The COVID groups I've been in have been some of the most supportive places where I've found peace. I found people who really, really understand. It's nothing like when you get inside of a group and they can tell you some things that you've been saying in your own mind. Well, you know, yeah, I have this inflammation, and yeah, I have, you know, dizziness, and you know, it was a couple of other people who were going blind as well. And for me to be able to find people in those communities like me made me feel less alone. I mean, the day I joined one of those groups, I was contemplating suicide because I was so, so sick. I couldn't even leave my bed. I thought to myself, you know, if my life can't get any better than not being able to lift my head off a pillow, I just will end it all by taking a bottle of pills. But when I started to become more active in those social groups, I started to find that people were lifting each other up, you know, encouraging one another, passing on health advice, even because we weren't getting any. Each day in those groups, I found myself becoming more of myself, but now with the support of other people who were suffering just like I was.
You know better than I that the impact of COVID-19 has fallen heavily on Black and Brown communities, and there are now a sizable number of people who are living with chronic conditions. What are your concerns as we look ahead to the end of the pandemic?
You know, I read recently in a study that Black women lost more jobs in 2020 than any other race of people and other genders. And it concerned me because I'm thinking about, you know, the Black woman in Baltimore City who may not know what she's sick with, but she's been sick for a couple of weeks or a couple of months with flu-like symptoms that may be long COVID. And she has children, or she has a career or a job to get to, and she can't continue to work like myself, you know, and the impact of the economy, you know, our personal economies when we cannot work, the impact that it'll have on our families, the impact that it'll have on the health industry. I mean, I'm looking at my own situation and the fact that I am moving into a space where I have to consider myself to be a disabled person and how that's greatly impacting my life. So I am concerned about the Black and Brown people who, first of all, don't even know what they may be sick with, and then those who are not going to be able to support themselves because they simply can't do their jobs. So we have a long road to travel in trying to offer minority people help and support with benefits and maybe, you know, health insurance that can support us, because we are going to need that in the next year and sadly the years after that.
You have not been able to return to teaching, right?
I have not. And that has been one of the most devastating things in this recovery journey, is that I cannot do the thing that I love. I love being a Baltimore City public school teacher. For the last 5 years, I have been the best teacher I knew how to be to my middle school students. And the worst thing each and every day I struggle with is having to face the fact that due to no fault of my own, I may never be able to do the thing I love again. That hurts.
I hear that in your voice. Do you intend to take the vaccine?
I do. I am very much looking forward to it. You know, initially there was some angst and of course some anxiety for me because you know, there are, you know, side effects, you know, from the vaccine. And I'm talking to those within my groups, but I am very much looking forward to having the vaccine. I'm a little nervous, but I would rather take it. And I would encourage everybody else to, as opposed to getting COVID a second time. My life depends on it at this point.
Shamira, I'm grateful to you for talking to us. And oh, I wish you great health.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being with you today.
Shamira Smith is a COVID-19 survivor and an advocate for long-haul COVID patients. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Very glad you're with us. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.